Once again, this morning we look at something that Jesus actually taught as we continue in our winding down our study of the Gospel of Mark. We're in chapter 10 this morning, and we look at what Jesus actually taught about marriage, and along with it, divorce, and along with it, remarriage. So this is a controversial sermon, and be of good cheer. Next week will be as well, but not in the same way. If you go for this kind of stuff, then you're in a good spot. We're looking at Mark chapter 10. And we get into the business of marriage in the way we got into the subject of money last week, that is, Jesus responding to a publicly asked test question. As his opponents tried to catch him in a fault, tried to embarrass him before his fans, so to speak, and of course, while failing in every attempt, it sets up instruction or teaching about an important subject, which is, by definition, controversial. They were trying to catch Jesus in a controversy. So we're looking at Mark chapter 10, and we start with verses 1 to 4 to set the thing up. And he left there, that is, Jesus left Capernaum, the city that was the base of his operations up in the north country, up in Galilee. He left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered to him again. And again, as was his custom, he taught them. And Pharisees came up, and in order to test him, asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" A very controversial question in those days. Those who took the Bible seriously, that is, the Old Testament seriously, were sharply divided on the issue of whether or not divorce was ever permissible at all, or whether it was actually quite all right under some circumstances. So they asked the question to see what side of this controversy he comes out on. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to send her away." Here they're quoting from Deuteronomy, in fact, Deuteronomy chapter 24, where divorce is regulated. Now, there are two big pieces to the Lord's answer to the question of whether or not it's lawful for a person to divorce his or her spouse. There's two pieces, and here's the first coming to us in verses 5 to 9. Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." I hope you can see what he's doing. They come to him with Deuteronomy, a book of the Bible, given through Moses by God. And Jesus takes them back beyond or before Deuteronomy, to the book of Genesis, and to the very beginning, where marriage is explained in its origins. So I have a couple of notes this morning, and the first note shows us that divorce is a reality, but it is a concession. Moses granted it, and Moses was serving God. We ought not to think that Moses was coming up with some sort of subordinate policy. Too bad for us. Moses gets in the way. It's not like that at all. Moses is speaking the words of God. When the people talked about Moses, they could have been saying God, except that they had a real reluctance to use the name of God. So Moses was almost, you know, a code word for saying God gave us this through Moses. God granted the concession of divorce. But marriage is God's original idea. That's where Jesus starts as he answers the controversial question and shows that marriage is, by its very nature, a very challenging concept. So here's note one. Marriage was invented by God as a permanent union between a man and a woman. This is very clear from Genesis and the explanation of the beginning of marriage. It's a permanent union between a man and a woman, and there is the challenge. Take two people, members of the opposite sex, considering the difference that gender makes, recognize you've got two people who are very different in a lot of ways, some quite incomprehensible to each other. And marriage is that means by which God intends to make one out of these two opposites. So it's a little bit unnatural that two opposite people would become one. And it's made more unlikely, more challenging, more unnatural in that God means for them to be permanently one. It's a permanent union between a man and a woman, which marriage is. So that's his first answer. It puts divorce in its place and explains that in its inception, in its creation, marriage was invented by God as this challenging, permanent union between two members of the opposite sex. There are two big pieces to the Lord's answer. Here comes the second in verses 10 to 12. It happens later, interestingly. It happens in private. So he made this big statement, quoting from the book of Genesis in public, and then verse 10 says, in the house, which we don't know about, but it's someplace private where his disciples and he were, in the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter. Shows the controversy of it, that they would bring the subject up afterwards. So hold on here, what do you mean? Tell us what you mean. And he said to them what he meant. He said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So what Jesus says in private gets us into the thick of the controversy. And what he says in private is that divorce being what it is and marriage being what it is, here's the second note, divorcing your spouse to marry another is a serious sin. I would say, is a serious sin, period. Because he states it in a very matter-of-fact way. We should treat it as a very matter-of-fact statement. Divorcing your spouse to marry another is a serious sin, period. And it's almost not as if the people he was speaking to needed to be told this, because the people of the Old Covenant understood that matters in regard to marriage and the end of marriage was very serious business. But he emphasizes how serious it is by explaining that to divorce your spouse in order to marry another person is adultery. And in their minds, in their understanding, because they were equipped with the knowledge of the Old Testament, they recognized it to be serious. In fact, in those days, adultery was considered a capital offense. Adultery was one of the sentences, was one of the crimes for which you could be put to death. And if that seems over the top or unreasonable, understand the mindset of the Old Testament people. They understood adultery, the violation of marriage vows, to be an aggressive act of violence against the society. So what do you do when your society, when your country is being invaded by violent enemies who are killing people? Well, unless you're a pacifist, you take up your weapons and you go and you fight. And the death penalty is to be seen that way. Adultery is a crime against society, and the society needs to deal with it appropriately. Now, here we go. This is such a serious topic. This is such a great, big, complicated, serious topic that notes are not enough. I need to add a section. So in this sermon, along with the two notes, there are details. There are four details, actually, and two of them I think we can probably all be quite at peace with. They are pretty straightforward, the first two details. And the next two details are highly controversial, matters of opinion, and I'll make bold to give you my opinion for what it's worth. Okay, details about this whole business of divorce being adultery and marriage being permanent. Detail number one, trading up in your imagination is essentially the same serious sin. I use trading up to make the point clear. If a divorce is perpetuated specifically for the purpose of improving your life by arranging to be married to someone other than who you are presently married to, it's a serious sin even when it's only done in your imagination. We're now comparing what Jesus said in Mark to what Jesus said in other places. For example, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. Maybe these words are familiar to you. Jesus said, you've heard that it was said you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. And then if we were to read on in Matthew 5, we would see he goes and says the same violent thing about your right hand. If your right hand causes you to sin, then you should cut it off. And then gets into the very same sort of wording as we have him in Mark chapter 10, where he talks in Matthew 5 about the ramifications of divorce and your wife. All of which is to say that the seriousness of divorce and adultery being what it is, we need to keep our eyes and our hands and our hearts under strict control. And especially our hearts, as we go back to Mark chapter 10 and see how much all of this is a matter of the heart. Here's the second detail. Hard-heartedness interferes with a proper commitment to biblical marriage. When first asked about permission to divorce, Jesus says in Mark chapter 10, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. Moses wrote you this commandment. God gave you this commandment through Moses because of your hardness of heart. Now we take a deep breath. The complicatedness of this very serious sin being what it is. Anyone who ventures to try to make clear what's being said here is required to wander out into a pond of personal opinion. you got to do that. You get into matters of opinion pretty quickly. So this is me wading out into a pond of personal opinion right up to my neck. All right? I make myself vulnerable and tell you what I think we ought to make of the Scriptures in regard to this very strong statement against divorce being adultery. But before we do that, can I ask for a few moments to set up a context? We're looking into the Gospels at a very controversial issue. And what I want you to go with me on here is that if these statements in the Gospels were all we had been given by God, then a very simplistic view of divorce and remarriage would be appropriate. If we only pay attention to the Gospels in regard to marriage and divorce, we are capable of coming up with a really simple opinion about whether divorce is permitted and whether remarriage is permitted after divorce. But I want you to think about the fact that in regard to, there's no other issue which, in trying to sort out a difficulty, we restrict ourselves to the Gospels. And if we did, we would get into trouble. What I'm wanting you to see with me just now is that more of the Bible than the Gospels is necessary to sort out the difficulties of a big, complicated subject. For example, now this is just an illustration. I will now not talk about marriage and divorce and remarriage for a minute, okay? Let's say, coming off of last week's look at what Jesus really taught about money, one of us decides to get really serious about getting our money right. We want to be righteous in regard to our money. That would be a good thing. I'd be in favor of that. So what if that person who wants to get really serious about obeying God in regard to his money decides to do a really careful study of the Gospels in order to figure out what to do with his money, but decides that that would be good enough because he'll get the words of Jesus. You know, maybe his Bible has the words of Jesus in red ink. So he says, I'll just look at the red ink on money and I'll have what I need to be thoroughly biblical about money. So this person, trying to use the Gospels to sort out a very complicated subject, gets to Luke chapter 14. And there where Jesus is laying down the high standards of discipleship, he says in verse 33, so therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Period. Jesus said that. It's in red ink in Bibles where the quotations of Jesus are in red ink. Any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. If you want to be a disciple of Jesus, evidently, you must not own anything. You have to give everything away. Now, if our guy was using the Gospels to sort out his opinion of money and, for that matter, all personal possessions, he might remember by the time he gets to Luke chapter 14 that this fits exactly with what he saw in Mark chapter 10, which is where we looked last week for what Jesus taught about money. Because in Mark chapter 10, a bright young man, or young, rich, powerful man, came to Jesus. This was last week's text. And asked what he needed to do to inherit eternal life. And there in Mark chapter 10, verse 21, Jesus says, go, sell all that you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. So if a person was restricting his attention to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he would see how the pieces all line up. He would look at Luke 14 and say, if I want to be a disciple of Christ, I've got to renounce everything that I have. Could that be true? And then he would remember the rich young ruler and what Jesus said to him. So, yeah, I guess it's true. Because the rich young ruler was told that he had to give everything he had to the poor. So I guess that's true. I guess that a real disciple of Christ does not have any right to own anything. We need to completely give up all our possessions. It says so plainly in the words of Jesus. And what I want you to see, as wrong as it sounds, is that more of the Bible than the Gospels is necessary to get a complete biblical view. That is, the words of Jesus are not enough. Does that ever sound wrong? The words of Jesus are not enough. Or look at it differently. From Genesis to Revelation, we have the words of Jesus. Jesus is the second person of the Trinity. He is the eternal Son of God. The whole of the Bible is the word of Christ. Just because a particular part of the Bible is not in red ink doesn't mean it's not the words of Jesus. It's just not one of the words which he was quoted on when he was walking around the Middle East. If a person got over this idea of forming his entire opinion about money from the Gospels and just kept reading in the New Testament, he would come soon enough to the book of Acts. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and then the book of Acts. he would get to chapter 5 and see the great controversy that occurred in the early days of the New Testament church when many people were selling all their possessions and giving the money to the apostles to distribute to the church. And one man named Ananias pretended to do that, but wasn't doing it really. And in Acts chapter 5, verse 4, the apostle Peter, an authority, says to Ananias about his money and his property, "While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not at your disposal? Why is it that you've contrived this deed in your heart? You've not lied to men, but to God." Now, look at that verse in the setting of its story, and you see that Peter was granting Ananias the right to personal property. He was saying, no one was compelling you to sell, and if you sold, no one was compelling you to give everything from the sale to the church. It was yours to decide what to do with. Not a hint of a suggestion that he had no right to hold on to it. So then you've got to take what is being given, for example, in Acts chapter 5, and mix it with what's been given in the words of Jesus in red ink, and sort it out. And this is what makes it such a complicated thing. We've got 66 books in our library. There's 66 books of the Bible. They are all the Word of God. They are all the words of Christ. We need to fit them together. And the difficulty we have in fitting some of the strong statements with some other strong statements is what makes it also complicated. And for some people, it's what makes Bible study so much fun. And for other people, it's what makes Bible study so difficult. But we need to do the same thing with the subject of marriage and divorce and remarriage as we do with the subject of money. We can't simply take plain statements, even given by Jesus himself, as if that's all there is to say about it. It's a dangerous thing to do. It's taking a very complicated thing and pretending or assuming that it's a very simple thing. And a complicated thing is not a simple thing. So let's get back to this complicated thing. And I've got two more details, and they're highly opinionated. It's my opinion. I give it to you because it might be helpful. At least gives you something to bounce off of as you sort out your understanding of these strong statements of Jesus in the context of the whole of the Bible. All right? Let me give a summary of the two details coming. I would say, personal opinion, that what else the Bible teaches on the subject of marriage and divorce helps us to see significantly that in our English Bibles, the words translated divorce refer to two distinctly different ways in which a marriage ends. Divorce always refers to the end of a marriage. You knew that already. But I want to show you that the way the word is used, the way the words that are translated divorce are used, shows that divorce refers to two very different ways that a marriage might come to an end. This is the complication. We're talking about a complicated thing, so we get complicated. All right? Now, because there's two ways in which a marriage might end by divorce, I've got two details or two personal opinions. Here's the first. It's detail number 3. The word divorce sometimes means the unrighteous breaking of a marriage covenant. It's referred to in the Scriptures as faithlessness. It's referred in the scriptures as treachery. And those words, depending on what translation you use, are found in Malachi chapter 2, one of the classic other passages on divorce. The word divorce sometimes means a very bad thing. It means the unrighteous breaking of a marriage covenant. It means being faithless. It means being treacherous. Here's where it says so, Malachi chapter 2. "The Lord no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand." That is, God is displeased with you, too displeased to accept worship from you. "But you say, why does he not? Why is God so displeased that he won't accept offerings from us?" And here's the answer. "Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant." Now, this is a very significant little piece of the Old Testament, because here is where you get the plain statement that marriage is a covenant, and so needs to be understood along the lines of a covenant's proceedings. And here's where you see that breaking a covenant, intentionally breaking the covenant of marriage, is considered faithlessness. Now, let's go on and see what else it says about it. These are the next two verses in Malachi chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. "So guard yourselves in your spirit, and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth. For the man who hates and divorces, says the Lord, the God of Israel, covers his garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So guard yourselves in your spirit and do not be faithless. So here are the details to that faithlessness by which the covenant of marriage is broken. God says, when a person starts to hate the one that he used to love and so divorces her, in doing so, he covers his clothes with violence. That's to say, breaking a marriage is an act of violence. Hating enough to put away your spouse is an act of violence which God takes a very strong stand against. He calls it faithlessness. He calls it treachery. So the warning comes through the prophet Malachi, guard yourselves in your spirit and do not be faithless. Now, some of you who are familiar with the subject might want to say, wait a minute, isn't this the part of the Bible where God says, I hate divorce? Let me say in answer to that, sort of. It is the place in the Old Testament where we read the words, I hate divorce, if we're reading the Old Testament in the New American Standard Version or the King James Version or the New International Version. It says right there, I hate divorce. And if you understand that translation to be correct, then, well, let me show it to you. Here's the New American Standard, verses 15 and 16. Take heed then to your spirit and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. For I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garment with wrong, says the Lord of hosts. So take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. The New American Standard translates as treacherously the word that the English Standard Version translates as faithlessness. These are synonyms. That's all the same thing. But the word hate shows up very differently between the two translations. For the more familiar translation, more familiar to me, I used the New American Standard for many years, has God saying, I hate divorce. But the way the English Standard Version translators deal with the Hebrew words, it comes out, for the man who hates and divorces is the one who covers his garment with violence. I'm wanting you to see right here that this very, very serious topic, which is not simple and therefore is complicated, is further complicated by the fact that we are looking at what God says in a translation, and some of the words being translated need to be considered from a number of different angles to get the point. But I'm not trying to say God doesn't hate divorce. I'm just showing you that in the English Standard Version, the word hate is transferred, as they do their best to translate the words accurately, from God's response to the divorce, which is very negative, to the person's action perpetuating the divorce. It's the man who's divorcing his wife who is the one hating. At any rate, however you understand the actual translation of the word, we can see that divorce here is referring to a treachery. It's referring to a faithlessness. It's a bad thing, a thing that God is against. Whether it's accurate to say that he hates it or not, certainly he is against it. For in this case, divorce means the unrighteous breaking of a marriage covenant. Okay? There's that. Some of you will be right on the page with me. Some of you will have other questions, and I'll have questions. Catch me sometime. But here's the fourth personal opinion. Here's the fourth detail, which is a personal opinion. This is where we get, I think, perhaps really lively. But cheer up. Some of you will now settle down. So, you know, it'll be great. Four. Detail four. The word divorce sometimes means the righteous response to the unrighteous, faithless, treacherous breaking of a marriage covenant. Can you see that? Whereas divorce is clearly sometimes the wicked breaking of a covenant, the Bible also uses the word to refer to the righteous response to the wicked breaking of a covenant. It's what the person who has suffered the treachery, it's what the person who suffers the faithlessness does in response to the treachery or the faithlessness. And some of you might want to say, where do you ever see that? Well, actually, I can show you that it shows up quite often in the Bible. But since we're in Malachi, I would say take one step to the right, turn to the next book of the Bible, which is the first part of the New Testament, which is Matthew. Look at Matthew chapter 1, settle yourself down into the Christmas story, and let me show you where divorce is the righteous response, or the attempt at a righteous response to faithlessness. Matthew chapter 1, verse 19, right in the middle of Matthew's version of the Christmas story, and we've got this man named Joseph, who is in a great deal of turmoil because of what he's just learned about his fiance, or what he thinks he just learned about his fiance. We read in verse 19 of Matthew chapter 1, And her husband Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. We've got two things here about Joseph, and they help us a lot, especially one of them. Look at the details of Matthew 1:19. Here's Joseph, misinformed, as it turns out, happily, but thinking very badly of the woman who is his wife by engagement, who is his fiancée. And being a just man, he what? Well, being a just man and misinformed about what she had been up to lately, as he learned that she was pregnant, being a just man, he resolved to divorce her. And there's not a hint here that that was bad on him. Quite the opposite. He was resolved to divorce her because he was a just or a righteous man and wanted to do the righteous thing, which is to respond righteously to an act of faithlessness. And happily, there was no act of faithlessness. She was still a virgin, though now she was with child. But he didn't know that. He operated on his best information, which, you know, unhappily for the time being was wrong. Happily turned out to be wrong. But being a just man, he resolved to divorce her. Now, the rest of the verse says, being unwilling to put her to shame, he decided to do what he was going to do quietly. He didn't want to do anything in a big public way that would bring her shame, because he loved her, because he was compassionate towards her. But he had no intention of continuing on in a marriage with a faithless person. So being a just man, he resolved to divorce her. There it is in Matthew chapter 1. And it just goes on and tells the story without any qualification or explanation. Matthew doesn't feel like he has to say, now, of course, it wasn't just of him to do it, but he thought it was just. He doesn't have to say that because it was just of him to do it. Because sometimes, matter of opinion here, divorce means the righteous response to the unrighteous or faithless or treacherous breaking of a marriage covenant. And if that seems like one puny little example and you need some more, I would remind you of how the book of Ezra ends, where God commands all the faithful men of Israel to divorce their wives because they had married foreign women and had no right to be married to them, and God had them in their, you know, righteousness, divorce. There's a great mass divorce at the end of Ezra. It's an ugly chapter of the Bible. Divorce is an ugly thing, however it comes about. But it was God's command that they divorce. And take a big step back and think of the whole Old Testament. And is the whole Old Testament not the story of how God married a nation? Israel was the wife of God, and a very unfaithful wife. And all of her idol worship was compared over and over again to harlotry and adultery. And isn't the Old Testament the story of God and His righteousness divorcing Israel? Whoa, now that's really controversial, so you'll want to think about that on a Sunday afternoon. But you got Matthew chapter 1 in front of you, and that's maybe enough to think about. What I'm wanting you to see, to help you with Mark chapter 10 and these other very plain statements that make divorce and remarriage seem like a very simple issue, is that you ought not to take a very simple stance on an issue that's not simple at all. Because although there's lots to hate about divorce, when by the word you mean treachery and faithlessness and walking away from your marriage partner, and God calls us against that sin, He calls us to take a stand against it, whether it's happening in our own lives or in the lives of people we know about, we should take a stand against it. On the other hand, there are times when a person is put into a position where being a complicated subject, and so lots of counsel and lots of prayer and lots of consideration is required, when the dust settles and the air clears, it's plain that what the righteous person needs to do, I believe, is to give this sinful relationship a proper ending. And divorce is the way to properly end it. In this case, when we're talking about divorce as a response to sin, divorce takes its place alongside some other complicated but absolutely necessary aspects of life. When divorce is a response to ungodly behavior, then it's like excommunication, which is a very hard thing. When a church recognizes that a certain member of the church is violating God's laws and God's principles so intentionally and so unrepentantly, there's nothing to do but expel that person from the church. That church is acting properly, though will be accused of being suddenly very lacking in compassion. But excommunication is the biblical response to sin that a church is sometimes required to put into action. And under certain circumstances, divorce is like that. It's like disinheritance when some beleaguered parents run out of other options and decide all they can do with the rebellious child who is perhaps deliberately intending to wreck the family. All the parents can do is to expel the child from the family, to disinherit the child and take away his proper place, her place in the family. And let's not hesitate to be completely controversial and say that in this case, divorce considered this way is like a society, like a civil government, like the state executing a criminal. And of course, death penalty is a very unpopular and very notorious notion. But in actual fact, it's a fairly complicated but frequent occurrence in the Old Testament. That is, a number of us could get our minds around the death penalty in the case of first-degree murder, but murder is only one of the capital offenses in the Old Testament. Other crimes are considered capital offenses and worthy of the death penalty, including adultery. And in every case, you need to understand the Old Testament. Don't let people make fun of the Old Testament on this point. The death penalty is placed on any crime which is considered to be a violent act of destruction of a society. So adultery gets the death penalty in the Old Testament because adultery is a deliberate destruction of a marriage, which is a deliberate destruction of the building block of society, and wreaks havoc in the home and devastates the children and the person who's being cheated on, but has a much farther ranging destructive effect on society. So what should society do about acts of aggression and destruction against it? Well, according to the Old Testament, the society needs to step up to the plate and act very aggressively against that. That's what the death penalty is. And that's what excommunication is. And that's what disinheritance is. And in certain circumstances, that's what divorce is. How's everybody doing? Okay, enough of just mucking around in the controversy. But I lay it out because Mark 10 happens. And one of the trick questions Jesus is asked is it lawful to divorce your wife? And Jesus answers simply, but you've got to take his simple answer in the context of the whole of the Bible, since it's not a simple question. And leave it to the wisdom of Jesus to answer a complicated thing in a simple way, and then leave it to our wisdom to set his simple answer in the context of all that the Bible says on the subject. And having been controversial for a while, and I think for long enough, let me just move on to the actions and talk really specifically and practically about what we should do, marriage being this serious, and the Bible saying what it does. And these actions are specifically addressed to those who are already married, because we are the ones who are on the spot to honor God in our marriages, but everyone is in contact with married people, and there's application of these principles about marriage to all of us, whether we're married or not, because we all have an influence on other married people. So here are two actions. Here's the first. Honor God and honor marriage, or your marriage if you're married, by strategizing permanent unity and by responding biblically to all threats to that unity. If you are a married person, you are under oath, you are obligated from God to strategize permanent unity, because that's what marriage is. Marriage is God's idea. It's a permanent union between a husband and a wife, between a man and a woman. And permanent unity is not a natural state, so you need to strategize to make it happen. And need to respond in a biblical way to all threats to that unity. There are threats from without. Threats come from without, and we need to respond biblically to them. Hebrews chapter 3 introduces the subject of honoring marriage itself. The writer says, "Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous." So as we love people, as you love your married brother and sister, as you love your parents who are married, as you love yourself, you need to protect them and yourself from the judgment of God. That is, protect everyone you can from sexual immorality and from adultery, because God will judge that serious sin. He will take a strong stand against it. And where a marriage, any marriage that we are in any contact with, is threatened with sexual sin, threatened by adultery, we all need together to conspire. We need to strategize the permanent unity of the marriages that are presently intact and respond biblically to all threats to that unity. And, of course, we're no more responsible for the preserving of a marriage than we are with our own marriages. It needs to be a high priority that we take a strong stand against any threat to the unity of our marriage, as if the world depends upon it, as if society depends upon it, as if our whole country depends upon it, because it does. Because the strength of the marriages of our society is the strength of our society to a great degree. And Jesus was speaking very plainly and simply and helpfully when he said in Mark chapter 10, "What God has joined together, let not man separate." We need to join him in that wisdom and see to it that no one is successful in separating two people who are married. That would be the first action. There are threats from without, but there are threats from within as well. And this, especially for us who are married, needs to be a very serious consideration as well. Every one of us who is currently married needs to recognize that from within the marriage itself, in our own relationship to our spouse, there are threats to the unity. For there are actions and there are attitudes and there are words and there are tones we can use that unite us to our spouses. And we need to be very careful to protect our marriages from the inside by strategically planning to use the actions and the attitudes and the words and the tones that will promote unity and more permanently bind us together. There's a way of saying everything that needs saying that is a bonding, unifying thing. The way you ask the person you're married to take out the garbage can be a unifying thing. Figure it out. If I was talking to a woman, I'd say it's really simple. You just say, "Honey, have I ever told you how attractive I find your biceps when you're carrying the garbage bag out to the garage? Could I see that again?" Men are not complicated. But the subject of permanent unity is complicated and requires a lot of wisdom. Now, along those lines, action B. And the subject is hard-heartedness. So here's action B. Keep your heart soft toward your spouse, and keep her heart or his heart soft towards you as a very important part of strategizing permanent unity. Being married to a member of the opposite sex has a hard-heartening effect, naturally, that we need to take our stand against. For example, husbands. In the advice that Paul gives, in the instruction that Paul gives to the Ephesian husbands, he says husbands should love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. So we are commanded to love our wives in a way that nourishes them and cherishes them. Let's think about this. And I don't mind at all just focusing on the husbands, because a number of you are, you know, here without your wives because they're away getting all spiritually renewed at the women's getaway. And wouldn't it be great if you were all renewed in your commitment to being a real swell guy to be married to when they show up this afternoon? Okay, so we're commanded to love in a way that nourishes and cherishes. Nourishing means feeding. And think about it, the words you use, the tone you use is like food you give your wife. And some food nourishes and some food poisons. And some tones that we use and some ways in which we behave just poisons the relationship and severs the connection. While other words and tones and actions that we take, what we choose, has a building up effect like healthy food. We're called to nourish the love, nourish our wives like we mean and have to nourish our own bodies. And the word cherishes is, I think, even more interesting than the word nourishes. Nourishes, obviously, is a word that, you know, comes from eating vocabulary, from the kitchen vocabulary. But cherishes comes from the art room. It comes from the sculptor's room. It's like clay and potter kind of vocabulary. Cherish means to soften by warming. Like you take a piece of plasticine, and if you want to shape it into any particular kind of shape, you have to warm it up. You have to soften it by warming it. So you rub the plasticine, the Play-Doh in your hands, and the friction of the action of your hands warms it up, and then it's shapeable. Well, we're told to love our wives in a way that warms them up, that softens them by warming. And softening is the opposite of hardening, and our hearts hardened are dangerous to a marriage, and our hearts soft towards one another is good for a marriage, so we're commanded, husbands, you're commanded to deal with your wife, to love your wife in a way that keeps her soft towards you by keeping her warm towards you. And there are things we can do and attitudes and words and tones that warm us up to each other. And there are things we can do and attitudes and words and tones that separate us from each other, that harden our hearts towards one another. And we should strategically plan to avoid all actions that harden our wives toward us or your husbands towards you. So now let me get shockingly plain. And, you know, the women are all away on retreat. It's just us guys, right? Okay. You know that the average man, this is just a scientific fact from medical labs, the average man passes gas 14 times a day. It's true. 14 times a day. So you tell me, gentlemen, why is it that when she was dating you and thinking of marrying you, your wife thought you were a happy exception to that rule? And why is it that once she married you, she found out that you were a pretty regular guy in that regard? I'll tell you why. It's because when we are trying to woo the woman that we hope to marry, whether we're successful or not, we are on our best behavior. We seek to be as polite as we can so we don't fart. And then we get married. And then we get at home. And our courtesy level plummets. And we just act naturally. It's a scientific fact that women pass gas 10 to 12 times a day. And if men aren't familiar with that statistic, it would be because it's the predisposition of some women to remain courteous through marriage, while men don't think to. And what we see here is the instruction to nourish our wives and cherish our wives by the way we conduct ourselves towards them. And there's all sorts of elaborate things you can do, having to do with phoning the florist and stopping at Laura Secord's and coming up with fun dates and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But besides the stuff like that that costs money, common courtesy goes a long way towards keeping your wife soft towards you by being warm towards her and keeping her warm by being soft and keeping her from getting a hard heart towards you. And just simply putting off male boorishness would go a long way towards that. So let us be courteous. Let us be gentlemen. I heard once that the definition of a gentleman is a man who butters his bread with a butter knife even when eating alone. Let's say the definition of a gentleman is a man who fights the physical averages even when alone. And whether he manages to do that or not is a little beside the point. But certainly being gentlemanly towards your wife, even when you're alone with her, is a good thing. Manners are a good thing. Common courtesy should not be uncommon in your relationship, because we're commanded to keep our hearts soft towards our spouses and to keep their hearts soft towards us as an important part of strategizing permanent unity. And listen, we started by saying this is complicated stuff. And in some cases, unity with your wife or your husband is a complicated challenge because of their state of mind, which may or may not have anything to do with your fault. May or may not. But if the person you're married to isn't easy to be permanently united to, it's all the more important that you strategize unity and you take deliberate actions and put into place specific restraints and guidelines of self-control to be a person that your spouse can be soft-hearted towards. It's all the more important when it's all the more difficult, which makes marriage sometimes a very great challenge. But whether your marriage is a great challenge to you or a great delight or some sort of puzzling combination of both, it's of great importance that you do everything you can to be well married for as long as you both shall live. So let me end with the glorious words of Peter, who wrote to Christians who were going through difficulties. Though I don't think he had marriage difficulties in mind, these great words apply nicely to that challenge as well. Here's Peter in his second letter. He says, "To all of us, God's divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. So in regard to your life and your godliness in your marriage, His divine power has granted us all things through the knowledge of Him who called us to His own glory and excellence, by which He has granted to us His precious and very great promises. God has given us promises which are precious and very great. And in those promises are all things that pertain to life and godliness, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. Marriages suffer corruption pretty naturally. We ourselves get corrupted in regard to the keeping of the vows that perhaps we entered into our marriage with every intention of keeping blamelessly. But God's grace is more than sufficient for all the challenges. And His precious and magnificent promises provide us with everything we need to be the godly people who live the life that God has called us to live. Whatever course your life takes, however much it's not in your control, as much as it's in your control, God has given you, God will give you, as you look to Him, He will continue to abundantly supply you with every help you need to be the husband or the wife or the single person who is a help to married people around you that God has positioned you to be. And may we be increasingly a church that makes known the greatness of God by the way we do marriage, the way we respond to hits on our marriage, the way we take on the challenges of being godly husbands and godly wives, and the way we do church with godly husbands and godly wives in our presence. Let it be that we explain to the world by the way we live our marriages that our God is a great, great God.